Welcome to this edition of the Panic Way podcast. Today I have another very special guest on the line, Dr. Reid Wilson. Dr. Wilson is a licensed psychologist who directs the Anxiety Disorder Treatment Center in Chapel Hill and Durham, North Carolina. He's also Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. He is author of Don't Panic, Taking Control of Anxiety Attacks, and co-author of Stop Obsessing, How to Overcome Your Obsessions and Compulsions. Welcome, Dr. Wilson. It's great to have you here with us today.
Oh, thank you, Barry.
You know, I always like to start these interviews by getting an understanding of our guest's background. Now, your speciality is treating people who suffer from anxiety disorders. Why are you so interested in working in the area of anxiety?
Well, my career prior to this was working with chronic pain patients, and a number of the skills that were useful for them turned out to be helpful as at least a start for people with anxiety disorders. So back in the 70s, mid-70s, the media around the country were talking about agoraphobia, and which is more severe panic disorder, and people just started to come in the door of psychologists, and most of us didn't know what to do, but I happened to have a leg up, as we would say, and started to work with them and found an affinity with people with anxiety for some reason, even though I don't suffer from an anxiety disorder and never have. And then there was very little to help me figure out what to do, so I began doing research and then decided to write my first book called Don't Panic, and I think it, I more or less trained myself over the 3 years that I spent writing Don't Panic.
Yeah, that's the book I wanted to talk to you about, because a lot of the listeners will be people who suffer from panic disorder, from frequent panic attacks. And I've just finished reading your book, Don't Panic. I thought it to be an excellent book for the listeners because, in my opinion, it goes straight to the heart of the problem. And what I mean by that is that in your book, you write, your resistance, your commitment to fight or avoid your discomfort actually causes your continued problem with panic. And then you go on to say the single most important way to win over panic attacks is to change your attitude towards the panic. Now, can you elaborate on that?
Sure. And interestingly, this is my third edition of the book. It came out in 1986 and then again in 1996 and then again in 2009. And this edition is really significantly different from the first two because I taught about 30 or so skills in the first two editions. And in this third edition, almost all of them are pushed to the back of the book where in part four, if you need more help, go here. And what is front and center now in this book is about attitude, disposition, point of view, frame of reference. All those words mean the same thing. It's because there are a certain number of people who can simply catch on to what you certainly understand is it is not so much about the symptoms, it is about my response to the sensations I'm experiencing or my response to the circumstance I walked into. And in this kind of mental game, if we can reframe how we're thinking about it and begin to, approach it in a different way and specifically approach it, then you don't have to learn all these other skills, breathing skills, meditation, relaxation, all the big talk today of mindful meditation. So that's really where things have changed.
Do you find it frustrating that people don't get, because in my opinion, this really is the solution to panic disorder, and it was the solution to end my own panic disorder by, embracing the fear, dealing with it, and not resisting it, not fighting against it. Do you find it frustrating that this message isn't communicated as frequently as it should be from therapists or from the literature that's out there?
Well, I feel frustrated for my patients. I personally don't get frustrated. I know in this field, like any other field in academics, that they're not going to open their door to a new point of view. In terms of researchers and academics, they have a point of view that they are researching and have that niche, and so you really have to push in on your own. And so I've been collecting more data now on research to justify this position. We have a big research project going now in this same way, and I understand the doors don't open. You just have to push on through, and so that's okay with me, but part of what we're up against is this mindfulness movement. And I think the experts in the field of mindfulness have it right, but the practitioners are reductionistic, are simplifying what they're teaching to clients. And when you think about what mindfulness is, it is this kind of a stepping back, compassionate, mm-hmm. objective look at my experience, and instead of attaching myself to my thoughts. And that is wonderful, and it is insufficient. You know, in a threatening situation, in a crisis situation, you must give yourself commands. Mm-hmm. When a firefighter goes into a building, when two pilots or a pilot and a co-pilot are working on the checklist before they take off in a plane, all those police officers and so forth, they are highly trained in operating by giving themselves commands, because in a threatening situation, as you know, your mind turns to mush, mm-hmm. and you don't want to be thinking about much, and you can't think about much. It has to be very simple, and it's certainly not sufficient to simply quiet yourself in a hot moment. You know, mm-hmm. the relaxation and meditation and such are designed for cool moments, but panic is a hot moment. So it's going to take work to turn this ship around, mm-hmm. but I think it can be done.
Do you think the mindfulness is more applicable then to general anxiety disorder and things like that?
Well, I think it's a little like the difference between meditation and hypnosis. Meditation is the platform within which people use hypnosis. Mindfulness is the platform within which we can step off of and begin to intervene in a threatening moment. But I have to say to myself, step forward, or whatever that reasonable facsimile of that message is. I must give myself an instruction that overrides the instinct from the midbrain, which is back up, run away, freeze. So, yeah. So it's again work to be done.
Yeah. Well, let's, if you don't mind, let's maybe give people a better idea of how this works, because there's so much good stuff in your book and the way you express things in different ways. It'll be really great for the listeners to hear that. Can we maybe take an example of how you teach somebody how to deal with the panic? Because in one section of your book, you have a bit on how to talk to panic. Maybe we could discuss that.
Sure. And I'm not sure how succinct I can be, but I'll certainly talk about parts of it. And how I want people to understand is the biggest thing we need to focus on is the fact that we resist. What else we do is really not important. We can do so many different things to intervene in an anxiety-provoking moment, as long as they encourage us to stop resisting, to be able to be in the present without fighting it. And so for decades, we've been working in what I would label a kind of permissive approach. I would say to myself, I can handle these feelings. And of course, you can't say that unless you've actually performed in such a way that you know you can handle your sensations. But it's kind of synchronistic. You got to be doing some of these things together. So I learn ways to manage the sensations of panic, and as you know, one of the ways you manage it is you do nothing, which is so funny. One of the best interventions for having anxiety is to not do anything at all. The American way is don't just stand there, do something. And mm-hmm. and what we do is don't just do something, stand there and wait it out, and things begin to change. So when you discover that through experiments, then this permissive approach of I can handle this and it's okay that I'm feeling these things can work pretty well. I tend to go to the provocative position instead of the permissive position as soon as I can, if not at the very beginning. And the provocative position is, of course, in one sense, going toward what it is that threatens me. Mm-hmm. And almost in a kind of caricature. Well, if we think back to some people will know Viktor Frankl, who back in World War II in concentration camps was a psychiatrist, and really out of his work came his logotherapy, and it is a way to provoke sensations paradoxically by encouraging them. And so for decades, what we would do, those of us doing provocative treatment, would say, you know, look for our most predominant uncomfortable physical sensation and instruct it to get stronger. So if my heart is racing, for me to say to myself, come on, heart, beat faster, which of course is a crazy thing to say, but it's very interesting when you start being willing to do this, what it does. So about 6 or 7 years ago, and I've been doing this for a couple of decades, and about 6 or 7 years ago, what I shifted in that protocol is, instead of asking that part of my body to increase its sensation, I would ask my clients to personify the disorder, take it outside of myself. So if we're talking about panic, it really works for all the anxiety disorders, but for panic disorder, it would be, in essence, come on, panic, make my heart beat faster. Mm-hmm. Now, a few benefits of that is, one is, it's not as confusing to people when we do it this way, even though it's a little crazy, which is, my job is to move ahead in whatever my valued activity is in this moment. When I start getting distracted by my sensations, I'm going to shift over and play this game, which is, I'm going to request that the anxiety disorder or panic disorder increase that which is frightening to me. And once I make that request, I turn my attention to whatever I am wanting to do at that moment. If 8 seconds later a fearful thought comes up around my sensations, I'm just going to do that exact same thing all over again. I don't listen in and say, is that working? Am I feeling better? Because working is me not being attached to changing my uncomfortable sensation. So that's in essence, and there's actually a very simple formula, which is, you know, a three-column kind of formula that's in that particular chapter, which is request, and we can request in all the different ways. We can beg it, demand it, cajole it, you know, hope that it will, and increase, make it stronger, make it harder, make it more confusing to me, and that last column being of whatever is I'm afraid of, which is, you know, my heart beating faster, having more confusion, you know, panic, please make me faint now. Would you, you know, I'll have people say, you know, please, if, you know, my heart rate is beating 90 beats a minute. That's so fast. I feel really scared about that. Panic, could you please make my heart beat 120 beats a minute? You know, Dr. Wilson's going to put $10,000 in my checking account tonight if I can get you to increase my heart rate up to 120 beats a minute. Please do that now. Now, of course, that's absurd. And we're not talking to the amygdala. We are talking to the prefrontal cortex. The reason I would do this crazy stuff is to keep myself from attaching myself to the threatening thoughts of, oh, what if this doesn't stop? What if it gets a little worse? So, as you know, there is no hardwiring from the prefrontal cortex to the amygdala that says, just kidding, I'm actually fine with this. So the only way the amygdala can learn is if we can put it in the threatening situation and let it just hang out there and discover that it's secreting too much adrenaline, too much epinephrine. And we can't accomplish that. In other words, we can't get the amygdala to learn if our talking, if our prefrontal cortex keeps stimulating the amygdala by saying, oh my God, I hope this works. If you know, things get bad, it's going to be horrible. And so that's really the reason that I would have people go to this extreme position, because for me to stand there and go, it's okay, I can handle this, I'll just let this pass, it's very easy for me to mouth those words, and at the same time be going, oh my gosh, I hope this works, because if I have a panic attack, that will be awful.
I'm finished now.
In essence, that's how we do that particular part of the work.
Yeah, and I think it's, so, you know, it's important to emphasize again that when you're doing that exercise, what you're saying is, move your attention back to what you're focusing on, to what you're doing, so that you don't obsess about your sensations. And then if the panic grabs you again, you do it again, but then move yourself back to the moment, back to what you were doing, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, one of the stories I talk about is I'm in North Carolina, which is in southern United States, and I had to give a talk up in Canada, and I was flying up to teach, and I decided to take a couple days off and go hiking up in the mountains, because the Canadian Rockies are just beautiful. And so I'm hiking, I spend, you know, whatever amount of money and extra time and planning and so forth. I get to this pristine environment. I'm 3.5 miles from the ridgeline of the Canadian Rockies. There's no one there. No one's in the parking lot of the national park, which of course I'm thrilled about. And here I am hiking after 4 months of planning, and I'm obsessing. I'm thinking about some dumb thing in my head that I am actually too embarrassed to tell you what it was I was obsessing about, but here I am in this beautiful location and I'm totally not present. I am up in my head and either I'm obsessing or I'm mad, you know, mm-hmm. obsess. Gosh, I can't believe I'm all the way here and I'm doing this, obsess. And on it goes until finally I say to myself, what do you do for a living? You know, and all of a sudden a thought came up about what I was going to do, which is my position at that moment became, as soon as I hear the obsession, so, you know, like anticipatory anxiety and the panic attack. Now, I'm saying this to you, as soon as I hear it, and that actually is an intervention in and of itself. In order to say, as soon as I hear it, I've had to step back away from that negative thought to label it as negative. So that in itself is a positive intervention. And as soon as I hear it, I say inside my mind, I probably said it out loud for a few times, thank you. Would you give that to me again? And then I turn my attention to the hike and so forth. Again, you know, 5 seconds later, the worry would come up. And I would just say that exact same thing over and over and over. And my position internally was, it doesn't matter how long this continues. I have my protocol, and I'm not going to waver from it. We don't want to be attached to an anxiety popping up inside the mind or a negative thought popping up, because that's going to be unconsciously mediated. You cannot stop a thought or feeling that comes from the unconscious. All you can do is respond to it. And so I'm not going to become attached to the idea of the sensation rising up. I'm going to then deal with what I do next. And it worked, you know, I wouldn't tell you the story unless it worked like a charm. You know, it took X number of minutes, but very slowly the obsession faded because I withdrew my energy from it. And so that's, I think, a good example of just one of the ways that it can happen.
It's, you know, in your book, you talk about Teflon and Velcro. I mean, that's that principle. It either bounces off you or it sticks to you.
Yes. And, you know, when you say this to young people, they don't know what Teflon is. So, but, you know, it's like a nonstick pan. You need to create
or the back of an iPhone.
Yeah. So you need to create a personality and a point of view that keeps anxiety from sticking to you. And, you know, if it is, oh my gosh, I hope it doesn't come back, oh my gosh, I hope this works, then you're going to be like Velcro, and it's helpful to personify the disorder. If these disorders sense that you are resisting it, they will just glom onto you. And it works like a charm to be going, fine, if this happens. You know, part of what we do want to do when we notice sensations that are uncomfortable for us is we do want to manipulate them. We do want to bring a change about them. But in the way we want to do it is we want to do it and say, okay, I'm going to now try this intervention. And if it works and my sensations diminish or my worry fades away, that'll be great. And if it doesn't work and they stick around, that's fine too. Mm-hmm. That's the position. So here we are, and this is the essence of paradox, which is I am attempting to generate change and simultaneously being willing to accept no change. It's a tough balance, but it's not complicated. It's difficult. And I don't really, you and I are trying to simplify something that can be complex for people, and we would never want to be diminishing someone's suffering. But the protocol, as you already know, is not complex. It's just hard. But at least people don't have to, study for years like you and I have done to figure everything out. Things have been figured out now. If you would just follow the rules... try it out, which is terribly risky, terribly risky. People that we work with have found their own way to manage their sensation as difficulties as the only way they can. And so it's very scary to let go of what you're holding on to without knowing how well the other one is going to work. So absolutely it's going to be threatening. No one said it was easy. It's just not complicated.
And isn't so much of this work, in particularly in the area of panic disorder, it's all really about the person building trust in their body again, learning to feel confident in their body again.
Yeah, certainly. And the interesting thing that starts first is they have to give trust in a protocol before they can trust their body. And that's even tougher sometimes, Who do they think they are? They don't know what this is like. Of course, when they're talking to you, they know that you do know what it's like. But it's difficult to give your trust in a protocol. I do an intensive 2-day treatment with people with panic disorder and social anxiety, and 8 people come in and they're palpably scared. Mm-hmm. And I've got 2 days to kind of change their mind. I can change their mind in about 3 hours if they'll be willing to listen to me, and then we practice. But that's the toughest part. Yes, you have to learn to trust yourself, but before anything, you have to trust a system that seems counter to your intuition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was talking with Dr. David Burns there recently, and he was making this point that the breakthrough, that moment of enlightenment using this approach, can happen very fast, and it can end years of suffering that the person may have gone through. Because also in your book, you say the amount of time that a person has suffered from anxiety doesn't really dictate how long it's going to take them to recover. People can suffer from years and get very fast results.
Oh, it's very interesting because it is a kind of insight. It is, and as Burns would say, and David Burns is one of my favorite trainers and teachers. I love his work and what he's done. I'd say it all the time with obsessive compulsive disorder. It's very similar, and I'd say to therapists when I'm training them, the severity of someone's symptoms, the severity of the disorder is not correlated with the prognosis. Means no matter how bad they look sitting in that seat across from you, don't take that as a sign of how difficult the work is going to be. I'm not saying I understand yet who catches on and who doesn't, who has to really work hard to catch on and who catches on in a snap. But some people are up like a phoenix. They understand the principles, and the principles can be, only 3 or 4 things, and when they catch on, and then they go out and try it on, because experience is the greatest teacher. These people, I work with them for 3 hours, and then they go at lunchtime for an hour and a half and do some practices out there, and then they come back in and go, oh, when I do this, that happens. Wow, I never thought that would happen. So that's what we're looking for, and yes, you're right, things can happen very rapidly.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I think we've really covered some concrete points on panic disorder because, a lot of people who are listening, would be a particular problem for them. There's another part of the group of listeners who panic disorder wouldn't necessarily be their issue. It would be more general anxiety. What's your overall approach to treating general anxiety disorder?
Well, we have to make sure we have the right people who are listening, and perhaps you and I may have different definitions of, mm-hmm. of generalized anxiety disorder. This does not mean people who, you know, generally feel anxious all day, but in our diagnosis, it is at least, you know, two of five big areas that you worry about: health, family and relationships, work or school, money. And then 91% of people with generalized anxiety disorder endorse the question, do you worry about minor things? So these people just get nickeled and dimed all day long with minor worries. So, and you know, it's not that different from what we've been talking about with panic disorder. The most important thing to start with is deciding whether the worry that has, because generalized anxiety disorder is basically people who worry. And so when I have a worry that pops up, I need to decide, is this a signal or is this noise? If it's a signal, then worry is supposed to be step one in the problem-solving process. My motto is anything that's worth worrying about is worth problem-solving. So you have to sit down, you know, brainstorm, you know, make sure you understand what the problem is and brainstorm solutions and go out and try them out and so on and so forth. If it is noise, meaning, you know, it's none of my business, or it's not time for me to be thinking about this particular problem, or there's no simple solution or no solution or whatever, if it's noise, then there's lots of things we can do to worries. Many people with generalized anxiety disorder do similar actions to people with panic disorder. For instance, you know, with panic disorder, people will, you know, have their first panic attack and rush to the emergency department thinking they're having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. They might do it once more or twice more, but after two or three times going to the hospital and hearing the physician say, you're just worried and really do nothing for them, they don't go to the hospital when they're having a panic attack. They stay at home thinking, oh my gosh, I'm having a heart attack. Well, that makes no sense whatsoever. And So, you know, again, with people who have generalized anxiety and they start to worry, we really want to help them clean up, is this a signal or is this noise? If it's noise, we have so many different things we can do with noisy worries. We can, you know, start singing them in our head instead of saying them. We can write them down like we're a stenographer in the courtroom. Every single utterance in our mind goes on a piece of paper. We can do things that make keeping the worry more difficult than getting rid of it. I have a term called being a good student of the work, which means if you decide to take on a piece of homework with our work, then you make sure you're going to do the homework. And if, you know, in 1 week you say, okay, every time I have a worry that is, you know, irrelevant, I'm going to start singing it in my head. Mm-hmm. Very quickly, that's an obnoxious exercise, and very quickly you decide, well, you know, I know I'm supposed to be singing this now, but maybe I'll just put this off for 10 minutes or a half hour, and then I'll get back to it later if I need to. And so all of a sudden, having to do these chores like singing it or writing it out when I'm worried will help empower the ability to put off a worry for a period of time. As soon as I postpone a worry, even if I get back to it in an hour, I have now taken an involuntary process, this spontaneous thought popping up unrequested, and made it voluntary by saying, I'm going to let myself worry, just not now. So it's one of the ways, you know, to the beginning of how we start to turn things around with people who have generalized anxiety disorder.
Yeah. Great. Well, you know, the burning question for most people who experience an anxiety disorder is, why me? Why has this happened to me? What caused this? What's your opinion on that?
Well, my first answer, and the little tongue-in-cheek, is who cares? I think it becomes a distraction for a lot of people. You know, I might say, were you breastfed? And if they say, yes, I was breastfed, I'll say, that's why. Or they'll say, no, I wasn't breastfed. And I'll say, well, that's why. Now, how has that helped you? Very often, you know, we could do some exploring to find out maybe some of the things that might have caused this. but it doesn't, it might satisfy someone inside themselves, and if that does help them, then we'll do it. But for the most part, it's like a physical disorder. Most interventions and medications and so forth for a physical disorder work regardless of how it was caused. We don't really, there can be multiple causes for certain disorders, but the treatment of it is the same. So I tend to, although I'll pay attention to it if requested, try to sidestep that as much as I can by let's just go and pay attention to what you need to do. I think there's certainly some genetic component involved. It really depends on which the anxiety disorders it is. I think obsessive compulsive disorder is almost 100% genetic. I think social anxiety, you know, we have something called dependent personality or avoidance personality disorder, and I think most people who have social anxiety almost always fit the criteria for what we call this axis two disorder, a kind of personality trait. Social shyness is the most genetically predicted personality trait that there is. You know, panic disorder, I think, has genetics involved to some degree with it, and we have some issues around early childhood loss sometimes. We have a theme which we talk about, external locus of control. Mm-hmm. So if I'm raised by an anxious parent who is protective, kind of over-controlling, then they start conveying to the child, listen to me, I'll tell you what to do about how to be safe. And so the child learns rules instead of trusting herself, her intuition, her thoughts, her feelings. If a child is raised by an aggressive, a domineering, critical parent, like some children raised by alcoholic parents, they also develop what we call external locus of control. If dad comes in the door, I never know when he's been drinking. If he's been drinking, he's violent with mother. I again learn it's safer for me to pay attention to how dad's doing than how I'm feeling in order to be safe. So grow these children up in those kinds of environments, and they are less aware of their internal feelings and wants and desires. They feel like kind of an empty shell. They don't really know who they are, and that can really set them up, if they have some genetic predisposition, to actually developing agoraphobia, not just panic disorder, but the really restricted lifestyle, because there's a great deal of insecurity that comes in those kind of situations. So I could go on and on about that.
I've heard you say that when a person, it was in a previous interview that you did, when a person experiences their first panic attack, that it can often be 6 to 8 months of previous stress that actually caused that moment of panic.
Yes, and what's the nature of that stress? It typically has to do with some form of loss, and that couples up with early childhood loss for some people. So, having the end of a relationship, moving away, a long-term illness, a death of a family member, all of those things in the previous 6 months can, almost like stepping stones, bring back, kind of put a tear in the defensive system psychically, and the threat of loss comes back up from early childhood losses, if there was a divorce in the family, so on and so forth. So we have found that you can interview somebody and talk about the last 6 months and see if they have one or two or more stressors. And now that I would, you know, I'd pretty much interpret that and hand it to them on a silver platter, which is, you know, here, no surprise that things started to go awry after these couple, three losses here for you, that somehow your psyche was fragile at that point, and that caused the panic attacks to begin. Not going to help us much on fixing it, except to the degree that we can say, oh, you've been thinking this is some kind of subtropical neurological disease that the doctors haven't found, and we can actually make some sense about how it started. But more importantly, it's how it gets maintained. Once it shows up, I begin to develop some ways to fight it that ends up, oddly, to encourage it.
Good. Well, you know, the last thing I wanted to ask you about was you seem to have quite a good sense of humor. It comes across in your book and some of the video presentations I've seen. Do you find humor plays an important role in helping people with anxiety?
Well, that's my personality. I don't really develop that because I think that it would be helpful to people. I have just used what I have, but I think it has furthered the therapeutic goals with people. And you know, I, like you, am relatively enthusiastic about what I'm trying to coach people in, and some therapists will say, well, maybe it's all about your personality and not about the techniques or the approach. Mm-hmm. I hope to goodness that's not true. Yeah. But humor is a way to dissociate ourselves from problems and so forth. And I certainly don't use my humor to diminish someone, and I certainly do take the problem as highly serious. But if we can start, you know, I was filming a demonstration out in San Francisco 2 weeks ago with a woman who has claustrophobia, and the two issues of claustrophobia are suffocation, not going to be able to get my breath, and restriction. I can't get off. I can't get out. And so she's was talking about her fear of flying because I'm going to get trapped on the plane on the tarmac, and they're going to run out of air on the plane, and I'm going to die. And I was saying to her at that point, oh, yes, I've read all those articles in the newspaper about how many people have suffocated on a plane. And, you know, we laughed about that. Now, I did a bunch of exposure practices with her to help her deal with the theme of suffocation and so forth. And then she went out and took a flight and so forth. And she sent me an email back, and I was saying, well, what helped you the most when you took this flight? She said, you know, oddly enough, I remembered back about you joking around suffocation, and I didn't feel like you were making fun of me, but somehow landing on that seemed to help me in that moment. So, yeah. So people, I, you know, hopefully if you keep rapport with someone, the other reason I justify joking around is I want to keep this, I want to keep the treatment as light as possible. You know, I talk about this as a game, as a mental game, only because it is the most practical way to be thinking about it. And so I think the humor lightens things up because of that too.
Yeah, and I think it was Viktor Frankl who spoke about humor in that it helps you rise above the problem, you detach yourself from it, and you see it from a distance, gives you better perspective.
Yes, and I, you know, if you look at any of the work that Peter Levine has done around post-traumatic stress disorder, he and children, you know, he has a demonstration video of working with a child who had a near drowning experience in a pool, and this was a child who wasn't speaking yet. He was 3 years old, was really delayed in his speaking, and he, to work it through, would put pillows behind this boy and have him fall over backwards like he did into the pool onto these pillows. And as soon as he would fall, Levine would tickle him playfully and they would laugh and then do it over and over again as an intervention that worked beautifully. So I think there's a place for this dissociation from the attachment of this is serious, this is going to be awful, I'm going to have to really work hard in order to get better.
Yeah. Well, great. Thank you so much for your time. I think the listeners will have gotten so much out of this. Can you tell the listeners where they can find out more about your work and your book and your books?
Well, we have a website called anxieties.com, so that's plural. And it is actually the largest free self-help site for anxiety disorders on the Internet. So that's a nice place to look at, get free information about this kind of stuff. There is a store there, and they can look at Don't Panic, or I have a little book called Facing Panic and a book called Stop Obsessing for people with obsessive compulsive disorder and a package for fear of flying. But, you know, more importantly, I just, like you, trying to get this information out, and I encourage them to go on the website and spend as much time on there as you would like. We have about 16,000 new people who show up on the website each month working the program, and so I invite them to take a look without having to spend any money.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Wilson, for the interview.
Well, thanks for the time.